Christopher Columbus's discovery of America in 1492 opened an age of adventure and fierce competition by the major powers of that day for real and dreamt-of treasure. For more than 100 years after, the world was dominated by the vast and powerful Empire of Spain. Yet despite this Spanish power, in 1607 the English dared to establish a small settlement at Jamestown in present-day Virginia. If this fragile colony had failed, the British might well have turned their backs on the newly found land. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is New Perspectives on Jamestown. Today, pirates, silver, and imperial ambition. My first guests today are Sir John Huxtable Elliott, Professor of History at Oxford University in England, and historian Doug Ford of George Mason University. Sir John, let me start with you. Why were the early Spanish expeditions focused on the Caribbean and South America rather than North America? Was that just the luck of where they landed?
Well, it was partly because of that, and partly because, of course, they began to find large Indian populations who can be dominated and exploited. And then in 1545 and 46, they find what they've always been looking for, which is enormous deposits of silver. Europe is in desperate need of silver, and from that moment on, their whole emphasis is on controlling and dominating the silver-producing regions of the Americas and the areas that will protect them as well.
Why do you say that Europe was in need of silver?
Because it had an adverse balance of trade with the Far East, and the Chinese needed silver, and that's the only way the Europeans could buy the goods they need in the Far East.
They just couldn't find a product that was made in Europe that the people of China and India particularly wanted. I mean, you go into sail into Goa in India and offer the Indians wool when they have developed a magnificent cotton industry. Europe just didn't have commodities other than capital that the Asians were interested in. I think it's also important to understand that there were Spanish expeditions going up into North America, but what they didn't find was precious metals. And they found also that indigenous populations, instead of having developed great civilizations with a hierarchy and huge armies, they found smaller cultures, indigenous cultures, and they were very difficult to conquer because there was no one supreme leader.
Spain, in a sense, has become the superpower of 16th century Europe. And it's because of this enormous power given by the silver resources of the New World that the French and the English and later on the Dutch want to get in on the act as soon as they possibly can, either by way of privateering or by way of establishing their own settlements.
You put that so discreetly, privateering. What does that mean?
Privateering, one's person's pirate is another person's privateer, and vice versa. pirates are, privateers, I should say, are pirates who are licensed by their governments.
Word got back to Madrid in the 1560s that the French had established a colony in northern Florida that they called Fort Caroline. And not only were they committing acts of piracy from the Spanish point of view on the Spanish galleons, but they were Huguenots. They were French Protestants. So here were heretics committing piracy on the main line of economic lifeline of Spain. They took this very seriously, and the King of Spain himself commissioned one of his finest veterans, a seaman and a warrior, Menéndez de Áviles, to get out there and do something about these French heretics that were harassing Spain's vital interests.
And Pedro Menéndez de Áviles simply wiped out that colony in 1565.
Again, this is Spain's vital interest that's at stake here. This is a threat, direct threat to that line of silver that's supplying all the other Spanish preoccupations in Europe, especially the Turks, and also the rising power of France, and then all these pesky German Protestants who had appeared. Now here comes the Queen of England. She also is cozying up to the Protestants and tolerating this religion, which the Spanish saw as basically working for the devil. And I think it's often difficult for us to appreciate how important these religious disputes were to 16th and 17th century people. And it colors everything. It colors the long relationship between Elizabeth of England and Philip of Spain. Her willingness to tolerate and indeed endorse Protestantism just outraged the Spanish, and they saw themselves as crusading against the spread of Protestantism the same way, I guess, in the 20th century, the United States saw itself as being the linchpin of the struggle against communism. And any advance on the part of the Protestant heretics against the Roman Catholic world was regarded as a setback. And that's why this is so important to understand the context of that time.
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's a global struggle of the forces of light against the forces of darkness as each side sees the other. And I think we're in a better position in the early 21st century to understand this than the 20th century was, in the sense that we now realize the enormous emotive power of religion and the way it can be a driving force for nationalism.
The Spanish brought diseases that wiped out untold numbers of native people in South America. Would you tell us about this devastating period?
Something like 90% of the indigenous population of areas touched by the Spaniards, particularly the densely populated areas of central Mexico and coastal Peru, lost something like 90% over the course of a century. Some people have said there were 5 million inhabitants of Mexico at the time of Cortes' arrival. Some say there were 25 million, but they're down to just 2 or 3 million by the end of the century.
Millions perish. Nobody at the time understood why, but the Spanish got the blame for it, although they had no idea they were carrying smallpox viruses and measles and all of that. They didn't know that. But they witnessed this terrible depopulation, horrible suffering, and found themselves in control of a land that had been despoiled by pestilence.
That's horrifying. How did the Spanish react to having wiped out so much of the population? How did this affect their plans?
I think what happens here is obviously your labor force is disappearing very fast. And the Spaniards begin to look around for alternative sources of labor. And the first Portuguese slaves came by way of Portugal. Probably something like 150,000 blacks were imported into Iberian America during the course of the 16th century, which is a large number.
Were the Indians also enslaved? Was there a difference between the importation of black slaves from Africa and the use of labor on the part of the native Indians in South America?
Yes, well, technically, there is a real difference, because Queen Isabella of Spain, when she heard about the Indians being enslaved by the first settlers in Hispaniola, was absolutely furious about this and said that these people are my vassals and they're not to be enslaved. The Spanish crown consistently, over the 3 centuries of Spanish rule in the Americas, sought to protect the Indians from exploitation by the settler population.
Some of the Spaniards were deeply upset by the initial enslavement of these indigenous populations, the Indians in America. And this was debated in court before the Emperor Charles, the King of Spain, a debate that quoted St. Augustine and the whole doctrine of the just war. I mean, they go back into Roman history to get precedence for what was happening. When it was all over, the king agreed, we should not be enslaving these people. We have a moral obligation as Christians to convert them. It's a tragedy that the church did so well in trying to protect the indigenous population of the Americas, but sort of looked the other way at African slavery because it was already a well-established practice.
What lessons did the British take from the Spanish in terms of how they would treat these native populations? Are there parallels?
Well, the first settlers of Virginia have a mentality very much like the first settlers, conquistadores of Mexico. They want to find gold and silver, dominate large Indian populations, and live like lords and gentlemen. But one thing that did happen in the Spanish world, which didn't happen in the British American world, and which is an extremely important difference between them, is that the Spaniards had no hesitation about taking concubines and mistresses among the Indian population. And at the upper levels, there was also a certain amount of intermarriage. There was intermarriage with Inca princesses and with Aztec princesses and so on. Well, now, of course, we've got the famous example in Virginia of John Rolfe and Pocahontas. But after that, there's a fascinating passage in Robert Beverley's account of the history and present state of Virginia, which came out in 1705, in which he writes that intermarriage had been indeed the method proposed by the Indians in the beginning, and I can't but think it would have been happy for that country, that's for Virginia, had they embraced this proposal. The abundance of blood that was shed on both sides would have been saved. And it shows the road not taken by the English, the road that was taken by the Spaniards.
I think it's also important to recall that at the time of the founding of Jamestown, the French had moved into Nova Scotia, and in about the same time, 2 years later, they were at Quebec already. And their attitude toward indigenous peoples was quite different than the English attitude, and that's going to show up as late as the French and Indian War, where the French were able to count on considerable support from Native Americans, and the English couldn't rely on them much at all.
Sir John, I'm curious. Americans tout Jamestown as the first permanent English settlement. Is Jamestown at all known by the average citizen of England?
I think the Mayflower is more on the radar, it has to be said. I think if you talked to the average English person about Jamestown, they wouldn't have much idea. I think Virginia rings more bells than Jamestown, actually, in the English mind. It's the beginning of everything as far as the British-American world is concerned. And the fact that Virginia was able to make a success of itself showed that the English could colonize successfully, just as the Spaniards had colonized successfully in Central and South America, and pointed the way to the others.
Sir John and Doug, many thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Douglas Ford is former executive secretary of National Phi Beta Kappa and adjunct professor of history at George Mason University. Sir John Huxtable Elliott is Regius Professor of History at Oxford University, England, and the author of numerous books, including his most recent, Empires of the Atlantic World. My next guest is historian Henry Kamen of Barcelona, Spain. He explores the serendipitous nature of the Spanish involvement in the New World. In looking at Spanish involvement in the Americas, do we need to be more careful about collapsing the 300 years of time that the Spaniards were involved in North and South America?
I think one of the problems involved here is simply the way we like to narrate stories about the past. We narrate all the events as though they happened one after the other, and yet in America, this never happens. Let me take an example. Let's assume that you are given an important administrative job in Virginia, and you're delighted to have had it, and then you turn up for your first day of work 30 years later. Now, that more or less is what happens in America. Columbus apparently discovers the American lands in 1492, but Cortes does not conquer the city of Mexico until 30 years later. The beginnings of Spanish Florida, that happens 60 years after the discovery of America. The whole ballgame had changed completely. Generations had grown up and disappeared, and there were new players in the game above all.
So how should we understand the initial Spanish ambitions and motivations and how they changed significantly?
It's difficult to pinpoint any real Spanish motivation, because even for them, it was a surprise. From the accounts that we have of Cortes and his men discovering Mexico, they were overwhelmed by what they saw. And Pizarro was overwhelmed by the gold and silver that he discovered in Peru. It's therefore difficult to look for any plan. Above all, to look for any government plan, because remember that all these people are individuals without government contracts. They go and do their thing, and then when they discover something, they get in touch with the government and say, look, I did this. Please, can I have the appropriate reward?
What about the surprise over the discovery of silver? How did they discover that? And how did they describe in drop-jaw disbelief what they'd stumbled across?
The biggest discovery of all, which they made in the mainland of South America, turned out to be an entire mountain made of silver. And one day, one of the Indian slaves working for a Spanish farmer came to him with a plant which he'd pulled up, saying, look, what are these funny round globules at the roots of the plant? And the Spaniard realized that they were silver globules, pure silver. But the problem was how to exploit the silver. Once you encounter a mountain of silver, who is going to work it? And it turned out the Indians couldn't.
Really?
The Indians couldn't because they were unused to the heavy labor involved in this type of mining. So tens of thousands of them died. The Spaniards had to begin a system of importing black slaves from Africa.
What was the aim of Spain? Was it to settle these two continents, North and South America, with vast numbers of its own people, or to leverage the few that came over in ships?
There were very few Spaniards there to do anything. We are told that Cortes conquered Mexico. The truth is, of course, he didn't conquer Mexico. Mexico was a city of about 500,000 people, and he had about 900 Spaniards with him. So what the Spaniards were trying to do was to do a lot with a very few people, which cuts out immediately any idea of settlement. The first settlements that Columbus left in the New World died, disappeared. In the whole of the two Americas, there were about 60,000 Spaniards, and that is 80 years after the discovery of America. Clearly not enough to control North and South America. In the early 16th century, almost with total impunity, foreign sailors destroyed all the main cities of the Caribbean. And so we go on. It's a non-stop story of the Spaniards being unable to construct an empire along the lines that we too easily assume existed in Spanish America.
So how do you account for this superpower unable to hold on to this steady pipeline of silver that was fueling the empire back in Spain?
That was part of the problem. What it was not able to do was to guarantee the safety of that money, either in America or outside America. The reason for that is it did not have any naval forces.
But I thought Spain had the world's most fantastic and great navy at that time.
Well, apart from one very famous case at the end of the 16th century, when a fleet in the Mediterranean defeated the Turks, every Spanish naval action in the 16th century and the 17th century is a defeat.
So in the Spanish involvement in North and South America, did there come to be a time, suddenly or gradually, where the silver was less of the focus and Spain was interested in something else?
Yes, because the silver gradually ceased to be the motive force of the economy of the New World.
Why is that?
Because the settlers there couldn't live by eating gold and silver. If we take the case of St. Augustine in Florida, that at no stage do the settlers of St. Augustine call for more silver and more gold. What they call for is, please send us more pants, more food, please send us some wine here. And these were the essential elements of colonial civilization, not gold and silver. There are other features which are of much greater importance. Fish. The Spaniards discovered that cod could be fished infinitely and in infinite quantities off the Newfoundland coast. There were more vessels plying the Atlantic just for catching fish than there were crossing the Atlantic to the Caribbean to take part in the silver trade. In other words, fish became more important than silver.
Surely, however, fish could not have been more lucrative for the national and private coffers than silver.
That could be true, except for the fact that the silver which the Spaniards collected in such big quantities had one dreadful consequence. It drove up prices, and so Spain began to suffer inflation, and that had a very bad impact on the standard of living in Spain. But the second big consequence was that because silver was so valuable, foreign traders began to send their goods to America to trade. And so a large part of the transatlantic trade began to fall into the hands of foreign merchants, mainly French, Italians, Germans, and English, and then later Dutch. So bit by bit, this silver, which appears to have promised a beautiful future for Spain, began to be criticized already in books written at the end of the 16th century by writers who were very competent in understanding the phenomenon as being a disaster for Spain. They viewed the silver as a disaster.
That's so interesting. Henry Kamen, thank you for sharing your insights on new perspectives on Jamestown.
Thank you so much.
Henry Kamen is an historian and the author of several books about Spanish history, including Empire, How Spain Became a World Power. He lives in Barcelona, Spain. In contrast to the Spanish, the British came late to the mid-Atlantic region of North America. They first tried to establish a settlement at Roanoke in present-day North Carolina in 1586, but that failed. 20 years later, in what would become Virginia, they did quietly establish the Jamestown colony despite Spain's dominance in the new Atlantic world. My next guest, William & Mary historian James Horn, talks about life at Jamestown in the shadow of Spain. Was Spain aware of the Jamestown settlement? Was it considered merely a nuisance? Was Spain indifferent to those settlers and English ambitions for Virginia?
The Spanish knew as much about what was going on at Jamestown as the English. The Spanish ambassadors in London had an intricate spy network, both in London and also at Jamestown itself. The Spanish ambassador was writing back to the king, Philip III, in Madrid, telling him what was happening and urging the king to snuff out this colony. The Spanish had no intention of settling the Chesapeake. They were overstretched already. But they didn't want other European nations, either the French or English or Dutch, settling.
How frightened of the Spanish were the English?
The English saw the Spanish as the principal threat. There was never a moment in the first 5, maybe 10 years of Jamestown's history when there wasn't a danger of Spanish warships coming into the bay and destroying the settlement.
Did the Spanish and English ever confront each other at or near Jamestown?
Actually, they did. Very early on, a Spanish warship set off from San Agustin in the summer of 1609, passed by the outer banks of North Carolina and then into the Chesapeake Bay, and was just about to enter the James River before it was confronted by an English warship, captained by Samuel Argall, the treasurer, and a more powerful ship, so turned around and went back. Now, the irony here is that Argall's ship had only arrived maybe a day or two earlier. If Argall had been delayed, and if his ship had not been positioned there at the mouth of the James River, there's no question that the Spanish ship would have gone up the James River, and then seeing how feeble the English defences were at Jamestown, could well have decided to have taken on the English. The English at this point were mutinous. They were divided amongst themselves. There was the threat that at any moment that the Indians might attack. They might well have seen the Spanish as liberators, not as enemies. So there's a very good chance that had Argall not been positioned as he was, that this Spanish ship could have destroyed Jamestown and that would have been the end of it. What the English did was position their own warships in the James River both to deter any Spanish entering and also to provide warning. But if a Spanish fleet had arrived, then Jamestown could not possibly have survived an attack of that kind.
Why did the king ignore Jamestown?
I think that the main reason is that at the same time that Philip III was getting news of the possible danger the English presented in Virginia, he was also receiving reports at just how pitiful this colony was. Divided, fractious, dwindling in numbers, surrounded by hostile Indian peoples, the Powhatans. It really didn't look as if the colony was going to last very long. Most European colonies during this period actually failed. Jamestown is unique, as far as the English are concerned, in surviving. Jamestown is the first permanent settlement. What distinguishes Jamestown from other English settlements in America is precisely it survives. So it's the very weakness of Jamestown that actually helps it to survive, because Philip didn't want to go to the expense of sending a fleet when the colony would collapse of its own accord.
James Horn is director of the Rockefeller Library of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation and teaches history at the College of William & Mary. He's the author of A Land as God Made It, Jamestown and the Birth of America. New Perspectives on Jamestown is a production of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and was produced with the generous support of the Rosenstiel Foundation. Elliot Majerzyk and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our features. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5098. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.